Coming up on this week's episode of Mars Ready Now, Astra, not the acronym, prepares for first stage and separation launch test. What does Made in Space do? And we discuss the skills potentially valuable enough to buy your way into space.
Mars Ready Now is a manifesto. The new space race is real. People are hyped. But the terrible truth is that only a small fraction will ever actually know what it's like to travel beyond Earth. Most of those who wonder will never find out. We do not want to miss out on humanity's greatest adventure. When the call goes out, whenever that may be, we do not want to be unprepared. I'm your host, James Coombs. I'm joined by my good friend, Soren Childs, and this is Mars Ready Now. Hello and welcome to Mars Ready Now, Episode 3, the podcast that asks the question, are any of us ready to go to space? And perhaps more to the point, how can we be ready for what the future may hold? More on that later, but first, the news. It is August the 29th, 2020, and remember, we are not experts analyzing the news. Rather, we are enthusiasts exploring it. So let's start exploring. Soren, go to the news fields.
Well, I've already got them open, and it should come as no surprise that the headlines still today are that a U.S. spy satellite launch on what I believe was a Delta IV rocket has been delayed for a week after an abort in the final seconds. Lots of impressive fire going everywhere, but fortunately, we do not seem to have had a rapid, unscheduled disassembly on the pad.
Okay, but it did, like, catch fire?
Well, I think they were past the point of igniting.
Oh, here we go. I found thrusters, the article.
But they... Let's actually see what the news story says here on space.com.
Sure.
A Delta IV heavy rocket carrying a classified NROL-44 U.S. spy satellite is seen in a ULA video during a launch abort at Space Launch Complex 37B of the Cape Canaveral Air Force Station on August 29th. Oh. Okay, yeah, so that is literally just this morning. The launch of the new U.S. spy satellite on a massive Delta IV heavy rocket has been delayed at least a week after a last-minute abort prevented an attempted liftoff early Saturday. The abort occurred just 3 seconds before the planned launch of the clandestine satellite from Cape Canaveral at 3:28 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. According to the ULA, which built the heavy lift Delta IV heavy, bit redundant, but okay. The rocket's triple core first stage briefly fired up its three main engines, engulfing the booster's base in flames before flickering out in an abort.
It is better than blowing up on the launch pad.
It definitely is, yes. And
I mean, SpaceX has had plenty of aborts over the years.
Oh, sure. And I'm definitely not going to begrudge the U.S. military from firing up spy satellites because, you know, it's one of the few things that they definitely should be doing.
Right.
So, yeah, a bit of a unfortunate incident, but...
Okay.
Nothing we haven't seen before and been well prepared for. It's another day at the launch facility. We've got some rockets, more and more as time goes on, that are launching as scheduled, and this one happened to not make it off the ground.
That shouldn't put too much of a dent on the overall stuff going forward, though. Should be fine.
imagine. Yeah, I don't expect that. I don't expect this to make a big dent in the ULA or anything else, really. It's just that we happened to catch this piece of news just as it was breaking, so it's still experiencing its 15 hours of fame, but I fully expect that we won't hear much beyond a possible explanation of why the abort occurred.
Okay, well, hopefully by this time next week they'll have sorted it. I here have got a slightly amusing story, which I don't think we need to spend much time on, but I'll read it out anyway. So, you are aware of the Space Force?
Yes, I am aware of the Space Force. I'm still waiting to hear whether the enlisted personnel will be known as Space Rangers, but...
This story, then, will be right up your alley.
Oh, good grief.
This is from spacenews.com. Starfleet amendment puts Space Force in a political bind. And there's a picture of a guy who with an eye patch who looks kind of a bit like a pirate in a suit. Little bit, but that's unfair because he's got an eye patch, you know. I mean, anyway, the point is that there is an amendment in the House to change the ranks for the Space Force away from the ranks used by the Air Force and towards the ranks used by the Navy. Apparently, this is to the alleged reason for this is to so that the Space Force can be properly differentiated from the Air Force in much the same way that the Marines, I think, are differentiated from the Navy. I think that's the example that was given in terms of the ranks that they use. Yeah, but apparently the humorous thing, or the thing that is newsworthy specifically about this, is two things. Firstly, William Shatner has endorsed this proposal, and obviously that's newsworthy because it's basically saying, yeah, we want to be more like Star Trek.
Yes, and the king of space has spoken.
Yeah, and the other amusing point about this was that one of the people who didn't want the bill to go through said that he felt that if the bill went through, then it would simply make the Space Force the running butt joke the running punchline of every Star Trek joke. And that I kind of feel that he's a bit too late for that. I mean, have you seen what the Space Force logo looks like?
We should probably include it in the show notes here, but I'm looking it up.
Yeah, that.
Yeah, they're a little bit late to the avoiding being a Star Trek joke here.
Yeah, so for anyone who can't see, and if we aren't able to put up the picture in the show notes, the Space Force logo is a blue circle.
It's just the Starfleet logo.
Yeah, it is basically the Starfleet logo, but with a slightly more angular triangle instead of the curves that is in the Starfleet logo, and a few minor differences. But basically, it is just the Starfleet logo. I love it.
Wow.
So anyway. That was that's not really got anything to do with our future in space, but yeah. So, here's something that might be interesting and that will possibly affect us in a negative way. NASA puts solicitation for commercial free flyer station on hold. Let me just read this out. Okay. NASA says that while its long-term goal remains to support the development of commercial space stations that can eventually succeed the ISS, it's putting one solicitation to support their development on hold for now. Mwah, mwah, mwah. Okay. Washington. While NASA seeks to eventually transition from the International Space Station to commercial stations in low Earth orbit, the agent is putting blah, blah, blah on hold. One element of NASA's LEO commercial strategy announced in June 2019, was to fund development of commercial platforms, including both modules attached to the ISS, as well as commercial stations. Okay, so if it's not doing that, then what's it doing instead? NASA had also planned to use the Next Step program, which is the NASA's Next Space Technologies for Exploration partnership program, which is its partnership with a lot of commercial partners, for a separate solicitation known as Appendix K to support development of a standalone or free flyer commercial station. However, after issuing a draft solicitation last October and holding an industry day in November, the agency did not issue a final solicitation. Skipping ahead a little bit. Very important part of the strategy overall. We'll still be doing it in the future, someone said. We'll definitely want to do a free flyer acquisition, said Phil McAllister, Director of Commercial Spaceflight Program at NASA. Can't promise any specific timelines. Development of commercial space stations, part of NASA's long-term effort, blah, blah, blah. Not right now. NASA requested $150 million for its LEO commercialization efforts, but only received $15 million. Ah, that's why. They didn't get the money they wanted from Congress.
Figures.
$15 million. $15 million. You couldn't buy a freaking... Oh, I don't know. Anyway. Yeah, that's not a lot of money in the space industry. That is not a lot of money. Oh, well. Okay, so what else have you got?
Well, it looks like the Curiosity rover has spotted a dust devil over on Mars. The video's in black and white, but it's nonetheless a pretty little picture. I've got to say that weather phenomena was something I understood intellectually occurred on Mars, but actually... seeing the picture of it, it's actually kind of funny. There was this comic I read years and years ago. It was called Get Medieval, and it was about a bunch of humanoid aliens who visited Earth in the 1400s. And somewhere near the climax of this, they took a knight from France, and they took him to visit the moon. And he remarked, "This is what I thought Scotland looked like." And looking at the black and white photograph of the Martian landscape as this twister goes by in the distance, I'm thinking, yeah, that is an accurate statement. This is what I thought Scotland looked like.
Oh yeah, I just about see it. It's really faint. You really have to look carefully at the photo. It is a GIF, I should point out.
So. Yes. Yes, so there is a few frames of it.
Yeah, it's really faint. But then Mars has a very faint atmosphere, so I guess what do you expect?
Yeah.
Huh. That's cool.
So an interesting development to be certain. What does it have to say about this? NASA's Mars rover Curiosity has spotted a dust devil swirling through the parched red planet landscape. Curiosity photographed the dust devil on August 9th, capturing a spectral feature dancing along the border between dark and light slopes of Mars's 96-wide Gale crater. It's no surprise that these dry whirlwinds, which we also get here on Earth, are cropping up inside the crater these days, Curiosity team member said. It's almost summer in Gale Crater, which puts us in a period of strong surface heating, which lasts from early spring through midsummer. Claire Newman, an atmospheric scientist at Arizona-based company Aeolus Research.
Okay, here's something. Well, actually, I have two things, which are very...
It looks like Mars is getting a summer which coincidentally coincides with ours, and the weather there is expect strong winds.
Sorry, how bad did you say the winds were?
I didn't actually say how bad the winds were, I think. The only size or scale measurements I've got here are the diameter of the Gale crater. Where is the Gale crater?
I need a big map of Mars and I need to put it on my wall.
Probably.
I really want to know. While you're looking that up, I've got two things here, one of which is a news article, but what I actually found incredibly amusing, or, well, amusing, was that next to the article there is an advertisement. Would you like me to read you the advertisement?
On the podcast? Sure. Why not?
Okay, so here it's an advertisement on spacenews.com. It is relevant. It's the advertisement is of a very futuristic looking probe landing on what looks to be, what I'm assuming is the moon. And the headline says, "Combining innovation and heritage to return America to the moon," and then in bold, "to stay." And then underneath it's got the logo, which is the Human Landing System. Wait for this. National Team. It's the Human Landing System, the National Team. And it is the combined efforts of Blue Origin, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, and Draper. And they constitute the self-declared national team.
You can't see my face right now, but I'm making that weird face that Elon Musk made. What was it? You remember there was that. They used him for a reaction face. He's holding a microphone and sort of looking sideways with a look of confusion and vague disquiet on his face.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I think my face looks right now, except obviously not as handsome.
Sure. Well, it's just everything about this is just so, this advert, first off, the fact that they're advertising at all on spacenews.com and that they are, I don't know, it's just really kind of unusual. I also know a lot, obviously we know Blue Origin and we know Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman. Draper is interesting because Draper is a private, small scale startup, from what I understand, that is working on the final mile problem. It's how do you actually land on the moon? So they are the chappies who are developing the actual lander, and they're not a huge, you know, corporation or anything. They're a startup, privately funded, and they've only been at it for like I think 5 or 6 or 7 years or something like that. They're not very old. So obviously them being in the mix is very interesting, and I hope that they do well. I hope Blue Origin does well and Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman as well. I hope that they pull it off. I just find it so weird that they have declared themselves the national team.
See,
point number one is against who? Presumably the Chinese, I'm guessing, since they are the only other people in the... Well, I suppose the Russians might be going for a little bit as well. But the Chinese Space Agency is the only other... agency that I am aware of that has serious designs on the moon that could be considered a nation. Obviously, SpaceX has designs on the moon to a certain extent as well, but they're not a nation. So,
you see, James, if I start commenting on this, I'm going to move straight past Speculation Street and into Cynicism Boulevard, because...
Well, we don't want that too much. Yeah,
I'll confine myself to a few brief comments here.
Yeah, go for it.
Observe the headlines that we're seeing on Space News in your case and on space.com in my case. I what springs most readily to mind is, you know, the idea that those who can do and those who can't teach, right?
I've heard of it. I don't believe it to be quite so true these days, but yeah, I know the
idea.
You
are correct. I also think that it's not a wholly true statement, but it is a useful cliche for the purposes of this analogy, because those who can make headlines do, and we call them SpaceX. Those who can't buy ad space.
Yeah, I probably shouldn't. Yeah. You are talking to a marketer who, you know, buys advertising. But yeah, I completely understand what you mean.
Yeah, I mean that in order to remain relevant and in the popular consciousness,
yes.
This national team has decided to pool their mastheads and or pool their letterheads, I guess, and have gone and declared their ambition to land people on the moon. But I think that the reason they're buying ad space is because, apart from maybe a page 2 story to document the press conference, they wouldn't be able to get anyone's attention for it.
Well, presumably that's just because these chaps, they're still in the development mode of keep everything behind closed doors, don't show anyone, and which we have talked about many times on this 3-episode-old podcast, that they tend to have everything behind closed doors, and thus they lose the news war by default, and so they are using advertising to make up for it, which is being paid for, obviously, I would like to point out, by the US taxpayer, obviously, because that's where the revenue is coming from.
Well, James, I think we could continue to trash.
Anyway, hang on a minute. I have got one more news,
or whatever this is about. But
I have got one more news.
We don't have enough information to go on, I think.
This is true. I just found the advert to be noteworthy by its existence.
Fair enough. But until we get more information about any credible projects to actually land people on the moon, then
wait.
I'm before you jump on the line in here, James, work with me.
Yeah. Okay, just so long as it wasn't the Speculation Street line.
Oh, fine. Okay, it was that line. Why? What did you have in mind?
Well, because this advert was attached to a news story. And the news story is SpaceX to launch Maston Lunar Lander.
Hey!
Here we go. Maston Space Systems XL-1 lander will carry a set of NASA payloads, as well as those from other customers, to the South Pole of the Moon in late 2022. Washington.
Okay, so we're Maston a little Space ways out here still. But in fairness, they've this is a NASA payload, so obviously they're going to need to test and certify these things to heck and back.
Yep. The mission will carry payloads for NASA's Commercial Lunar Payload Services program under a $75 million contract awarded by the agency in April. So why is this news? Hang on a minute. Let me just... I mean, unless SpaceX has only just been announced as the... Okay, Maston joins a growing list of companies and organizations using SpaceX to launch lunar lander missions. Intuitive Machines, which won one of the first NASA CLPS awards last year, selected SpaceX to launch its IM-1 lunar lander mission on a Falcon 9 in 2021. So in 2021, we're going to have a private lunar lander launched by SpaceX, funded by NASA. And in 2022, we're going to have another one as well. Japanese company iSpace selected SpaceX in 2018 to launch its first two lunar missions, which at time were to be an orbiter and a lunar and a lander, launching in 2020 and 2021, respectively. Those have been pushed back to 2022 and 2023. So we've got four so far. And SpaceX has already launched one lunar lander mission, Bearsheet, or Bear Sheet, spelled B-E-R-E, sheet, Bear Sheet, the lunar lander built by Israel Aerospace Industries for the Israeli organization Space IL, which flew as a secondary payload on the SpaceX Falcon 9 launch of an Indonesian communication satellite in February. So, five. Oh, hang on a minute. That one, Bear Sheet used its onboard propulsion systems to move, but crashed attempting a landing in April 2019. Okay, so we've had one launch, one crash, and four future launches for SpaceX for lunar lander missions in the next 2 years. And I'd like to see what the national team's, you know, lineup looks by in comparison. It'd be interesting.
Yeah, I will believe that there is actually a workable plan for that as and when they say, here is the rocket and here is its payload, and you can photograph them to make sure that we're not pulling your leg.
Yeah.
Because until then, James, it's all just speculation.
There we go. Yes, this is, yeah, this is Speculation Street, the segment where we take one article, project, company, or anything else we might find, and then speculate wildly on what it could mean for the near-term future of humans in space. And this week's target is Made in Space. Who are they? What have they done? And what might this mean for the big picture?
And I would like to thank you, James, for selecting a organization that actually has some achievements under its belt already.
That Bigelow Aerospace has got a segment on the International Space Station.
Oh, no, that wasn't what I was meaning. I was meaning that rather than speculating on what on earth the national team is doing, we have decided to speculate on the future of something that's already done things.
Yes. So let's have a look. Let's just go through the Made in Space website and familiarize ourselves with the organization. We should be able to do this by going to the timeline.
Yeah, so it looks like they've...
Here we go. Why don't you start us off?
All right, so the company was apparently formally founded in 2010, but key research about the viability of microgravity additive manufacturing has been going on since the late 1990s. They were developing the technology immediately following their founding, and in 2013, they launched a 3D printer for zero-gravity experiments on the ISS, and then sometime the following year, I don't know when in 2013 the launch happened, it doesn't say on their timeline, but in November, late November of 2014, they remotely operated the 3D print payload to build the first parts ever made off Earth. And it looks like they were building wrenches.
Yeah. So this is the first company that has done actual in-space manufacturing.
Yes.
And they did it quite a long time ago, like 6 years ago.
Yeah.
So what have they done since then?
Well, it looks like they have been working on another project that they call Archinaut. Made in Space and NASA team up to expand on the vision of in-space manufacturing with the Archinaut program. The Archinaut is an in-space robotic manufacturing and assembling capability that builds large-scale space assets on orbit.
Oh, I want this so bad. Hold
your horses here, because I'm not seeing too much concrete information in their about section. Uh-huh. And I'm deciding to be like my 12th grade science teacher, who I used to think was a bit of a stick in the mud and taking a I'll get excited about it once I have a clearer idea of what they're doing here.
Fair enough. I'll get excited for everyone else on your behalf.
Yeah.
Because I'm excited. Because I really...
Oh, yes.
Large-scale infrastructure construction in space. Large-scale construction of infrastructure in space is one of these things that I'm just... I just want it really, really badly. And it's just kind of annoying because there's no real reason why we couldn't be doing it.
Yes, there is, James. Yeah. And it's the weight capacity of launch systems.
Yeah, but yes, there is so little
into asteroid mining, but just to bootstrap up to that point, you're talking about multiple starship-sized payloads fired off into the far reaches of the asteroid belt to scrape up enough materials to begin assembling more of them. We'd practically need to be most of the way to a full-blown von Neumann probe just to get to the point of a sustainable long-range solution to in-space assembly. Because until then...
I'm not entirely sure I agree with that. For those of you who don't know, a von Neumann probe is what?
It's a self-replicating space probe.
There we go.
So the idea here is that it's going to cost a lot more to get things out to where the materials are than it would to send something out there that can build more of itself.
It doesn't necessarily need to build more of itself, though. It just needs to build a very basic piece of infrastructure.
And what piece of infrastructure might that be?
I don't know.
If you don't know, James, then I don't really think you have a leg to stand on with contradicting me here.
Yeah, that's fair. Well, it's sort of fair enough, but at the same time, not really, because I don't see how building self-replicating robots is step one in building a near-Earth industrial base.
Oh, no. Step one is designing that capability.
Well, no, but it's not. We don't need to build self-replicating robots to build build an industrial base. We don't have self-replicating robots on Earth, but we have an impressive industrial base here.
But we also don't have the fuel requirements of sending things into orbit as part of building our on-Earth industrial base.
Yes, but my point is that you don't need a robot to build itself. You only need a robot to build the thing that you want to build. In this case, a space habitat, presumably, or a space station. You don't need... There is no good reason why you can't send up the robots to do the building. You don't need to send up a robot that is capable of building itself so that it can build more of itself, so that it can then build lots of other things. Yes, if you can do that, that is basically game over as far as infrastructure in orbit goes. I completely agree. But I do not believe that that is in any way stage one. Or that we will be ready to build a von Neumann probe before we have any kind of reasonable industry in near-Earth space. We really are in Speculation Street, aren't we? My lord.
Yes. The point I'm trying to get across here, James, is that, yes, being able to assemble things in space is a step towards building my hypothesized self-replicating robot probes, but sending up more materials to be assembled in low Earth orbit is probably going to work out to be more expensive in the long run than sending robots that can make many things, including additional robots, to more material-rich environments.
If you're talking, we're talking about moon and asteroid mining at the moment, right?
Sure.
My point is that between, in terms of robot in terms of remote drone capabilities, when you send a drone to an asteroid or the moon or wherever it is that doesn't have a huge ass gravity well in it, the capability to build a basic space habitat, for example, or even to build mere raw materials, which can then be shipped back to low Earth orbit or even like a Lagrange point in order to then manufacture them there into something more sophisticated, that capability is far lower on the sophistication scale than the ability to replicate themselves. So the first stage will almost certainly not involve robots that can replicate themselves. It will involve robots that can only make the final product. And then later on, yes, you may have robots that can replicate themselves as well. That's my point. My point is that's not stage one. Stage one is send up robots that can build the thing you want.
Okay, let's do this like we're designing something. What requirements do we have here? What do these robots need to be able to do in space in order to build things?
Okay, well, they'll need to be able to collect the very sort of coarse gravelly type material that would be on an asteroid, presumably. They'll need to refine it into various forms of metals or specific alloys. So they would need to be metallurgy involved, mixology or whatever it is.
Mixology is drinks.
Yeah, save that one for the space hotel. And then they would need to, well, the basic paradigm of just sending robots to an asteroid and bringing back raw materials to low Earth orbit would just then need to have them being able to move it back. So just the same mechanism by which they got there, but just a lot more of it. That's basically it. It's a very sophisticated technology, which we don't have yet, but it is not, it's a technology we don't have yet, but only because we haven't made it yet, is my point.
All right.
It certainly doesn't involve any new laws of physics. Orbit,
or wherever you're doing your manufacturing at.
More robots that build more complicated things. But the point is that the robot itself is the most complicated.
Like other robots.
Yeah. No. Well, I don't see
anything which has the sophistication to build something like the ISS would almost need to have the sophistication needed to build itself.
Okay, if we're talking about. So, yes. So long as we are accepting the fact that certain components will have to be shipped from Earth, like computer chips, for example, because I don't see incredibly sophisticated computer chips being manufactured in space orbit anytime soon by an autonomous robot.
And this is the part where it comes out that I actually dropped out of computer engineering, so my knowledge of the microchip manufacturing process is woefully incomplete. However,
my point is that regardless of
that, a lot of microchip manufacturing is already highly automated, and the question is only, can we get all the raw materials up in space? And I think the answer is yes.
Yeah, but so fair enough to a certain extent. Just not, there's no reason to make the chips in space, right? The chips are very small, incredibly sophisticated, and can be manufactured on Earth. It costs almost nothing on a per chip basis to send them into space.
Cargo, correct.
Yeah, they're very light and they're very valuable, by comparatively speaking. So you send them up, and the robots could then integrate them into robots that they are building in space using raw materials manufactured in space. Granted, that wouldn't technically be a von Neumann probe, but it's pretty close, I'll grant you. Okay, fair enough.
At a certain point, I suspect the volume of things being manufactured in space will reach a point where it will become more efficient to manufacture chips and PCBs in space than it will be to burn rockets to send them up.
Probably, although hopefully by that point we'll have skyhooks, so you know. Yeah. Or something similarly engineeringly sophisticated that can drastically lower the cost to orbit.
Yes, hopefully we will have some option, but that's getting outside the scope even of Speculation Street. So I think we should come back to talking about what Made in Space is actually getting up to. It looks like one of their other projects has been developing new materials in space. They're looking at growing industrial crystals in microgravity to larger sizes and improved quality compared to terrestrial sources. I'm not a mineralogist or a geologist, and as a consequence, I'm not familiar with what particular types of industrial crystals they might be trying to grow in microgravity. Do you have anything on that?
The only thing I have on this is that they are... I don't know about the crystals. I did see a news article, which is actually what put me onto Made in Space in the first place, about their fiber optic cable, which I believe they actually did succeed in creating a sample of. Yeah, here we go. Space-enabled Z-Blan optical fiber. Let me just read this out. Best-in-class fluoride-based fiber for medical, telecom, and research. So commercial manufacturing of microgravity-enabled optical fiber has enormous potential both on Earth and for space exploration. So in January 2018, the first Z-Blan optical fiber was manufactured on the International Space Station. And this... when produced in a strong gravitational environment such as Earth, exotic optical fiber is subject to tiny flaws. These crystals appear in the fiber and significantly increase signal loss. When considering data transmission lines, such as long-haul communication lines that can span thousands of miles, these flaws cause large enough attenuation of the transmitted light to make the system commercially infeasible. Though privately funded multi-year internal research and development work through privately funded multi-year internal research and development work, Made in Space has developed the expertise to successfully produce large quantities of high-grade optical fiber. MIS is partnered with Thor Labs, the industry leader in Z-Blan preforms and production on the material for terrestrial uses, to rapidly industrialize production of optical fiber in space.
And looking at other sources, I think that they may have already succeeded in producing some of this stuff.
Yes, they have, but only on the ISS.
Yeah.
But this is the thing that interests me incredibly about this is that the International Space Station is not a factory. It's a laboratory.
Yeah.
So if Made in Space wants to actually produce optical fiber to sell to the open market, it cannot do it on the International Space Station.
Uh-huh.
So it's going to need a space station of its own. It's the only conclusion I can come to. So we have a buyer, effectively. We have identified somebody who clearly is in the market for a private space habitat / space factory / space station. So that's interesting.
Yeah, if you made the whole thing autonomous, you wouldn't need an onboard crew. Maybe just like a handful of, a handful of redundant or backup manipulator arms that could be remote controlled.
Yeah.
Everything else is feed materials in one end, siphon materials off the other, and drop them back into the atmosphere.
For feasibility's sake, that probably depends on the method through which the manufacturing happens. But I do agree that that does sound feasible, if incredibly boring. Because we want people up there.
Oh, sure we do. But remember, it's the economics of things. So the question is, okay. Is there any Absolutely. Task that you require astronauts in space, one of the most dangerous environments known to man?
Yeah, you do. You
is there
need
any activity that you would require them to do which could not be automated?
Yes, actually. Anything that
requires of industrialism possible. On Earth can tell us that there are a very, very small handful of tasks that meet the description of cannot be automated.
Anything that requires communication that cannot be, that needs faster than light communication.
Excuse me.
If you have a person. Sorry?
What do you mean, anything that requires faster than light communication?
Well, if you have a person there doing the thing, then you can react to things instantaneously. Whereas if you're trying to control something from Earth, you have to wait for the communication to get there. And if you're talking about something, for example, in the asteroid belt, where it might take many, many minutes for a command to get there, then it might be better to have a person there who can just react immediately to the situation.
Okay, I see your point. I thought we were still talking about the Made in Space orbital fiber optic factory.
Okay, no, you are completely correct. That close to Earth, generally speaking, probably not. Although I would like to point out that the fact that the International Space Station exists and has humans on it is due to the fact that you cannot automate, or at least we currently don't have the capability to automate highly diverse actions. So if you're talking about a single process by which you shove raw materials in one end and get a finished product out the other, and you can build that all in one go and send it up, then fine. If ever you need to alter that process, having a person there is probably a good idea, which is why there are astronauts on the International Space Station, because they do lots and lots of different experiments.
Yeah, it's like you said, it's a lab. They're constantly switching up what experiments are being run in the racks up there.
So if we were thinking about
that, a human crew is on the requirements specification for the ISS.
Right. So if Made in Space and Thor Labs wanted to create a factory that could innovate and that could improve and that could actually, that could innovate and improve its process over time, then having an astronaut up there would probably be a very good idea.
Mm.
That's my thought.
But even then, I think you could probably get away with not having a permanent full-time crew. You might only need onboard crew if you were doing renovations.
Yeah, that's perfectly fair enough. I don't have a problem with that. Crud.
We need to replace the extruders completely rebuild the extruders, and that's going to require us to do more fine manipulation than we can trust to the Waldos up there. So suit up, boys. You're going to the Lagrange points.
Yeah, well, I could completely imagine a situation where a company has an automated factory in low Earth orbit, or at a Lagrange point for that matter, and you send up, and they only send up people for 1 week a year to do stuff, or as many weeks as they need. But the point is that you are completely correct. There is necessarily no specific reason why you need to have a crew up there all the time.
For certain applications.
Yeah. Yeah. Theoretically. I mean, the reason why the International Space Station needs to be manned at all times, but that is because it was designed so that it couldn't run without a crew.
Yeah.
Yeah. In any case, yeah, this is a... Have we speculated enough, do you think?
Well, let's just take one last run through the Made in Space website here. And
right,
let me just do a search. Yeah, here it is. The
space-enabled industrial
Archonaut thing. Archonaut is a made-in-space enterprise solution for in-space manufacturing needs, enabling next generation of large-scale off-world manufacturing. It is a technology suite that combines additive manufacturing with robotic assembly for remote in-space construction of large, complex structures, implementing these on orbit servicing, assembly, and manufacturing. Capabilities also enables the repair and reconstitution of existing satellite assets. Okay, so it's looking like it's going to be a... looks like it's going to be a additive manufacturing, so that's 3D printing and robotic assembly, so that's probably like a Waldo arm. So it's going to be a 3D printer with a Waldo arm hooked up to it for assembling multi-part things that were printed. You print the parts on orbit as required, and then your robot arm puts them together.
Yes. I also noticed that they have a graph here where they basically say, look, we can make your solar arrays a lot bigger. And then they just expand them out. So instead of having 16 solar panels on the International Space Station, they have about three times that many with their system. And I think this is basically just saying we can build trusses really large in space. It looks like that's what they're suggesting anyway.
Yes, that does sound like what they're going for here, that their Archonaut technology will make it possible to, among other things, assemble much larger solar arrays in space.
That could be really good for developing a power sat business.
True. But you've already seen people go ballistic at the mere sight of Starlink satellites and their solar panel reflections. Do you think...
Well, no, hang on. No.
From significantly larger solar arrays.
Yeah, but it's not, though, is it? Because it's not the solar panels that... It's not the solar panels that cause the reflectivity in Starlink, is it? It's the dishes. Because the solar panels don't face the Earth, do they? They face the sun.
I seem to recall seeing somewhere that what I'm recalling is that somewhere somebody from SpaceX made a statement about how they were making adjustments to the solar arrays to minimize the reflections that people were seeing. But until I look that up and can confirm it, this is all just speculation.
Yeah, you caught me out there.
Yeah, we need to work on some sort of signal for that.
Oh, yeah. And anyway, just like that, we move into T-minus unknown, in which we talk specifically about being Mars ready now, whether this is something we're doing ourselves to prepare for humanity's future in space, or thoughts we've had about the general principles, so that if and when the time comes, we're not all massively disappointed. So, this week, and this is going to sound like it's massively off topic, but bear with me.
Go for it.
I have been constructing a sort of a loft bed slash stair system slash mezzanine in my apartment.
Ah, yes. Because as we all know, the lumber and carpentry industry of Mars is a much anticipated boom.
Yeah, well, this is exactly it. You see, I've been enjoying myself a lot. I find woodworking to be relaxing and, quite frankly, very satisfying. Wood is an amazing raw material. God, if I went to Mars, I think one of the things that I would really like to do is try to set up some kind of agroforestry business. Now, I know that you might say that that's incredibly impractical, but it probably is. But I don't know. It would be cool. I don't know. I don't think a place is home.
And you are prone to succumbing to the rule of cool here.
Yeah, I am. But I don't know. If a place has
a Von Neumann probe when you can send poor schmucks out to the asteroid belt. Yeah, that one's going to fly right along with your agroforestry on Mars.
Look, when we have Von Neumann probes, then fine. But we don't have Von Neumann probes. So until we have Von Neumann probes, it's schleps, it's very rich schmucks being sent out to the asteroid belt. The point that I'm trying to make is that you're right. Woodworking is not a particularly valuable skill that is going to be useful on Mars or in space. I enjoy it, and I'm still going to continue working on it. It's very useful here on Earth when you quickly want to put something together. Probably not going to be so useful in space. However, I do believe that moving on from our discussion that we had last week when we talked about the benefits of entrepreneurship and how if you want to be Mars ready now, then taking some financial responsibility for yourself is, generally speaking, probably going to be part of the package.
Certainly.
There are other ways of
the alternative of being an indentured serf on the Manticore Colony Limited.
Yeah. Well, there are other ways of doing it. And one of the ways of doing it is by having a valuable skill that will be necessary on Mars.
True, which is why when you studied space. The woodworking, I was trying to break into 3D printing. Unfortunately, Pruce has got a 3-week lead time plus shipping, so my printer is still going to be a while in getting here, and I'm definitely behind the curve on that technology anyways, so.
Mm-hmm. It'd be interesting to look into the 3D printing technology that the Made in Space chappies are using. Find out how similar it is to the standard printing
solution we've got here.
Yeah. I mean, presumably, if you don't have gravity, then that does sort of put a bit of a problem on things, because a lot of standard 3D printers do use gravity.
James.
Yeah. Although, having said that, the resin printers that are home-based, they don't really use gravity, do they?
Hold down the fluid, yes. James.
They do that.
You would expect the extruder types, like the Prusa Mendel models, to probably be closer to what they're actually doing up there.
Yeah, that's fair
because
enough.
Because I don't think that having a bunch of resin globules floating around the ISS is going to be too good for anyone's health.
No, I can see that. No, you're completely right. Yeah, the bed of liquid. Yeah, that does need gravity, doesn't it? Yeah, okay,
yeah.
Fair enough. Okay, so it probably is just the standard thing then. It would be very interesting to see. Mm. But here's the thing. I was thinking that most likely the exact technology that would be most useful, especially right at the start of space colonization efforts, will be in-house technologies that are being developed by specific companies rather than a generalized skill set.
Definitely.
So SpaceX or Blue Origin or one of the other chappies says, we've got a specific form of technology here. You who worked on it, you're going up. That's kind of what I'm imagining.
I expect you are correct.
The problem with that is that that basically requires you to be I don't want to say win the lottery, but it means that if you intend to take that exact route for with the goal of being one of the first or in the first batch of colonists, then it basically means that you have to weave your way through a very small needlehead in order to achieve your goal. You need to make sure that you get a job at either SpaceX or Blue Origin and preferably pick the winner. Odds are at the moment that's looking like it'll be SpaceX, but Blue Origin could, you know, come up with something incredible that blows us all out of the water.
Good grief, man. Are you simping for Jeff Bezos?
No, but I do.
Because I've been kind of wondering how you've been so lenient on them all this time.
I want humanity to become a multiplanetary species. Yes, I kind of like SpaceX, but if Blue Origin are ultimately the ones who achieve it, then I'm just like, fine. You know, just so long as we do it. That's my feeling on this, right? And it also doesn't change the fact that regardless of who you are, quote unquote, simping for, we're looking at this from a pragmatic point of view. And if you want to be the one who gets up there, you need to pick the winner.
Why I've said that the only job offer that I will jump at unquestioningly is software developer, because it's my field, at SpaceX.
Mm-hmm. Right, but is a software developer likely to?
Because of rule of cool, but more realistically, I will take anything that might potentially lead to an on-orbit or interplanetary position.
Yeah, but that's exactly my point, isn't it? Would it? I mean, the thing about being a software engineer is that your product is inherently information-based. You know, you can teleport it up with light. Well, you know what I mean, teleport. You know, you can move it with light or radio waves or whatever. Why? The point is that I don't see anything as a software developer that you can do that can't be done on the ground. On Earth. So, you know, there's a massive crisis that happens on Mars. The fact that there is a 7 minutes or, you know, possibly longer, depending on how far away Mars is from Earth, the fact that there may be a 7 minute variable window between you and there, that's not probably going to mean much, because if you're desperately in a crisis situation or a development situation, you can wait 7 minutes, can't you? I mean, many software
hardware redundancies that will make it unnecessary to have a on-site software developer, at least in the early days.
Many developers say,
I don't expect that eventually there will be software developer positions out there.
So what do you need then? One, what do you need? And two, how likely it is that you can thread the needle to make this work?
Yes, thank you. I was going to call you on that after I was done giving you hell for the Jeff Bezos thing. Is you thread needles, James. You don't weave them. Remind me, which one of us is the professional wordsmith?
Yes. Well, like I said, I am the professional wordsmith on the written word, not necessarily the spoken word. Although I did, you know, spend quite a bit of time in Toastmaster and various other organizations, so I should be better than I am. But ho-hum. In any case, what, if not software developer, then what? Roboticist?
Roboticists would be a good option, but the thing is that you're probably looking at more technicians and technologists level of training rather than top of the line expert in the field, because at a certain level of competence you become too valuable to risk in space.
Yeah, that's a good point. Or how, what about, I'm almost thinking of something like, you know, civil engineer or something, because when you get to, if you got to Mars, what exactly are you doing there when you land? You land in your starship.
Not doing the design work of a civil engineer. That, like software, can be teleported, as you put it, to the other planet. What you have is the people who know how to manually operate the construction droids or whatever they're using.
So that's what you need then. You need to be a competent
construction robot operator.
Yeah. And this is obviously in-house tech, it's unlikely that you're going to be operating a GCB or a JCB or a digger. Actually, you probably would, now I think about it. You probably would be operating one of them. Why not? You'd be operating a massive heavy equipment
3D printer online, and once I've used it to print parts for my gingery lathe and milling machine and drill press and the rest of it, I will thereafter begin working on designs for construction robots.
Yeah. Electricians. I think you're going to need a lot of electricians because there's going to be a lot of stuff that needs to be wired up.
That's a good one, yes. You would need electricians. Oh, you know what? There is a specialization that you can get after your basic PADI dive certifications that specifically deals with people who are doing trades work in a scuba diving environment. So you're probably going to need people with that particular specialization of the certification. People who are familiar with using life support hardware in an environment where they are doing skilled manual labor.
Yeah, like people who do the welding for underwater bridges.
Yes, that.
Like that. That, yeah. That's a skill that would be quite useful. Yeah, because, I mean, all of the stuff that happens outside of the habitats or outside of the starship, especially when you first get to Mars, it's all going to be extravehicular stuff. It's all going to be space suit up kind of thing. So you're going to basically be up welding. Incidentally, welding in a spacesuit sounds absolutely terrifying.
Maybe we should invite somebody whose professional job description is scuba welder onto the program to talk us through the dangers of their job as well as the training requirements.
So it's basically anything that... So here's what you do. You take anything that requires scuba on Earth, and then you combine it with specialist trade stuff that is required in basic construction. So electricians, heavy earth moving. What else? Concrete. I don't know. Can you make concrete on Mars? No, probably not. You need a lot of limestone. I'm not quite sure what the soil composition of Mars is. I don't think it's... I don't know.
Well, the thing about concrete is it's a cement and an aggregate. So you've got plenty of things over there that you can use for an aggregate.
Aggregate.
But because you don't have the... you might not have ready access to limestone, you won't be able to make Portland cement. But I suspect, actually, you know what? There's already been work done on a cement or bonding agent that can be used with aggregate that can be found on Mars, specifically for habitat construction.
Hang on, isn't limestone just like stone that's made up of like organic materials like shells and stuff?
I believe so.
Yeah, limestone is a carbonate sedimentary rock that is often composed of the skeletal fragments of marine organisms such as coral, blah blah, mollusks, etc. Presumably, if we found limestone on Mars, then everyone would flip out because it basically means that we've confirmed that there was life on Mars.
Yes.
So the fact that everyone hasn't flipped out probably suggests that there isn't any limestone on Mars.
Quite likely.
On the other hand, can calcium carbonate form in the absence of life?
No idea, but I'm looking at... Let's see here. article from Popular Mechanics where they're looking at concrete habitats for Mars. There was a 3D printed habitat challenge, and a team worked out some recipe for Martian concrete.
Huh.
So I don't know if they're shipping their cement up with them and then just using whatever's to hand for aggregate or what, but it looks like they've definitely got a working prototype of their concrete 3D printing apparatus.
Also boring. So tunnel building and stuff like that.
Well, obviously. I mean, we haven't discussed it on this podcast, but you and I have previously discussed the fact that Elon Musk's boring company has the potential to be useful for space colony construction technology.
Yeah, I mean, Mr. Musk does have a tendency to strategically overlap the capabilities of his companies.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I would also be saw just in the last... When did that press conference happen?
Oh, God. I think it was yesterday. Yeah, Gertrude Pigg from Neuralink. Oh my God.
Wow, that was quite something. We're going to have psychic control of the welding robots.
Yeah, for those of you who don't know what we're talking about, yesterday, as we record this episode, Elon Musk hosted a web conference in which he...
Which he called a product demonstration.
Yeah, a product demonstration in which he showcased three pigs, each one of which had been, two of which had been implanted with his Neuralink project, which is a whole bunch of a brain computer interface system. Yeah, a brain computer interface system so that you can measure and also record and also input electronic stuff into the brain. With the idea of eventually augmenting humanity in the long run, and in the short term helping people like paraplegics get some control back over their lives, which is great. But it was also incredibly amusing because it's just so Elon Musk. Everything about it was unbelievably Musk. In any case, I'm going to continue my woodwork, even though it doesn't have particular space applications at the moment, but I am going to consider the possibility of targeting my other ventures in a space-related manner if I possibly can. What about you?
I am going to work on developing the 3D printing and robotics skills. I'm also going to be... Now that I've managed to accumulate funds for paying for the 3D printer, the next savings goal is going to be saving up to do my dive certification. And the much smaller, thankfully, savings goal of getting myself the Flight Simulator 2020, because that is something both my dad and I have been eagerly waiting for.
Ah, yes. That is quite an impressive piece of software, I understand.
Yeah, it sure is. Yeah. You were telling me earlier that a fellow from NASA's flight control had taken a simulated Cessna and flown over Boca Chica?
Close. It was Kevin from SpaceX Central, SpaceX Centric, the YouTube channel.
Oh, that fellow. Okay.
Yeah, that fellow. The nominal dude. The nominal dude.
All systems nominal.
All systems nominal. In any case, we're running a bit over time, so I think we'll finish up, yeah?
I mean, I was just going to mention in connection to my ambitions in 3D printing that I would also be touching on some very light woodwork in preparing the flasks that I would need to cast parts for the machines in Dave Gingery's Machine Shop from Scrap series.
Oh, that's really cool. Yeah, I'm looking forward to hearing how you do with that.
Yeah, I found a fellow on YouTube. I believe his channel name is Maker Size, compound of makers and exercise. And he has gone and followed Dave Gingery's original recipe, which was
for those of you who don't know what we're talking about. This is a very quick and dirty method to make at home the basic tools in a metalworking shop that are required for making everything else. So it's a lathe, a mill. What else was it?
Drill press, sheet metal break, dividing head. Chain gears for your lathe. It's basically you build the simple tools that you need to make more complicated tools in order to improve your simple tools to the point that you can do the crazy things like cutting threads.
Oh yeah, also add that to the list of skills which definitely will be useful on Mars. Machinist.
I mean, why did you think I was doing this, James?
Okay, fair enough. Fair enough. In any case. So, on that note,
I'd
say something else about it,
because I've also just received a note slipped under my door that we have bacon.
Ah, jealous. Okay, I don't want to keep you from that. So, on that note, it is goodbye from me, James Coombs.
And it's goodbye from me, Soren Childs.
And remember, prepare now, because the future is sooner than we think. The journey continues. Thank you for listening. Thank you to everyone who supports us. Be sure to subscribe and review. We really appreciate it. And if you're ready to go one step further, head on over to marsreadynow.com to read and commit to the Mars Ready Now manifesto. To win in space first requires you to win on Earth. Again, that's marsreadynow.com, link in the description.